Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. In this conversation today, I'm joined by Claire Dale, who is the founder of the Physical Intelligence Institute. This was a fascinating conversation. We're going to be talking about how we can leverage our physical intelligence in coaching. And in particular, we'll talk a lot about the chemical compositions in our bodies and how we can learn as coaches to support our clients to begin to, through embodiment, activate different compositions of chemicals that then make different types of leadership and ways of being possible. So we'll go deeply into the types of chemicals in our bodies and the responses that emerge, and then what are the types of coaching interventions that we can bring that then allow us to fire up these chemical compositions that are conducive to skillful means and skillful action. It's really, for me, a fascinating angle on the potency of physical intelligence and embodied coaching. So Claire Dale is a movement specialist, an international speaker, and co-author of the award-winning book Physical Intelligence. Claire is a coach. She trains and consults to help individuals and teams achieve peak performance through physical intelligence. She has a background in contemporary dance. And as an advisor to Nasreen Sheikh, the director of the Empowerment Collective, Claire is actively working to campaign for global human rights and an end to modern day slavery. If you're a coach, you can head to coachesrising.com to check out our acclaimed trainings or join our ever-growing community of transformational coaches by putting your name in the sign-up box you'll find there on the homepage. All right, let's dive right in. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used. How to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey. So I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. So, Claire, it's really great to be with you today. How are things with you?
Things are very good in the sense that I'm alive and my body's functioning, fighting off a cold. So I'm celebrating the immune system that is doing what this incredible body is meant to do, which is all the time trying to get on the side of life. And so I always find when I have down days, you know, physically the body doesn't feel quite right. It's an opportunity to just dig deep and celebrate what the body is doing. So you find me on a less than par day with my body, but I'm equally happy to talk on that kind of day about the body as any other kind of day where I might feel I've got loads of energy. So that's where I am. I'm in Twickenham. It's very rainy. I'm enjoying the rain, and it's November and the leaves have practically fallen. So I'm glad for the coolness of winter as well, the coolness on my skin when I go out.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well, actually, there's a great tee up to our conversation today in terms of you've brought this body of work into the world around physical intelligence. And that has been, for me, actually personally, a huge kind of revelation as someone who's a, you know, dedicated spiritual practitioner and coach and all these things. But actually to come back to this, like, love and honoring of just the immense intelligence and and resourcefulness that is our physicality, you know. So I'm really excited for our conversation. And so, yeah, we'll talk about your work today and how it applies to coaching. So maybe a good place to begin is just to lay the foundation and ask you if you could tell us what physical intelligence is for you.
Yes, I'd love to. In 2004, I was at a conference with lots of coaches and leadership development professionals. And I was new to that world then. I was just making my way out of a career in contemporary dance, running my own dance company. And I decided at that point that the body, I always knew that the body itself was rather underestimated, and we didn't have a very clear language to express the rather mysterious language of the body, and that as dancers we got very good at working with the internal mysteries and ebbs and flows of sensation in the body. So I was determined to take what we knew as dancers to a wider world. I had no idea what I was going to do or how I was going to do it, but I by accident got invited to this conference. And the afternoon of the conference was open space after some keynote speeches in the morning. Everyone was talking about emotional intelligence. It was about, I don't know, something like five, seven, 8 years old at that point. And I decided to offer a session, and I was given a flip chart and a space, and I put the flip chart pen up onto the paper. And literally out of my arm came the words, physical intelligence, everyone welcome. I didn't know that was going to happen. I was really pleasantly surprised, and immediately that moment felt right to, you know, to encourage the use of that term that placed the body in equal footing along with other intelligences that I think we were all hearing about at that point. So that was the birth of the term physical intelligence. And what it's come to mean now, many, many years later, is the ability, really, the intelligence with which to understand and strategically manage, if you like, the inner chemistry of the body, the inner world of the body, through the lens of some of the chemistry that shifts and flows and might stagnate or might suddenly, you know, be flowing more vigorously. And this lens of the chemistry seems to give us a layer of language that can be helpful to describe feeling, sensation, and change in the body. So the active management of our physiology, our neurochemistry, so that we can, and what we've done is just like anything, we need to break some of the big chunks into smaller chunks to be able to sort of understand them and work with them in different ways. So our four elements, as we call them, are our inner strength. That's our adrenal stability. It also aligns with physical strength, but essentially inner strength, flexibility, agility, creativity as a second element. Then the much used word and a very important word, resilience. How do we construct a resilient life that's beyond just kind of getting on with it and hoping the body comes along for the ride and doing a few things to help the body, but really constructing a resilient life. And then the fourth element is endurance, which is like cultivating stamina, being able to work with your energy to be able to rest and conjure up grit, some determination perhaps when we're getting through what we might call an endurance tunnel. So managing our energy for the future is really in the present and in the future is really what endurance is about. So that's in a nutshell how we've over the years learned to frame physical intelligence.
Is it that there's like these different chemical compositions that can fire up and that we can begin then to, you know, to work with skillfully in our own experience or with clients? to then, you know, to then bring in these different qualities that you just named, these four different qualities.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. We've simplified to a very complicated system to a look initially at eight key chemicals. And playfully, we call that balancing act that you've talked about the winning cocktail for any situation. So if you're in a situation and you've gone in with loads of cortisol and dopamine because it's exciting and you want more of it, and actually you meet people who are in a different place, then you might need to call on serotonin and oxytocin in order to transform one's presence. And this is a very just a very simple top level example of how we might nudge our chemistry. And there are specific physical movement based, breath based ways that some will be familiar. It's very familiar to people, and some might be things that kids do automatically. Some might be breathing patterns that we associate with other things, but actually also have an incredible impact on the inner chemistry. So it's giving that amazing physiology more of a voice, of learning it, having a construct that helps us change. So yeah, adapting the chemistry is just right. That's exactly what it's fun to do, and sometimes it's vital to do.
Yeah, I find that fascinating, because actually when I was reading about chemicals in your work, and as you were speaking about them, you know, I was thinking of it in terms of, you know, if you're feeling tired or stressed or contracted, you know, what are the kind of physical ways you can kind of fire some of these chemicals to bring you into states of renewal or deeper performance. But actually, I'm also hearing it's fascinating that you can actually like learn to kind of like attune yourself physically and chemically to the environment that you're in and the people there, so that you're, you know, in the best skillful means in that moment.
Yeah, and the connection to coaching right there is super important. And settling in a chemistry and being able to shift it, as well as what, you know, as well as mirror it or be with it, or, you know, let one's chemistry contrast or connect, depending on what's appropriate. So I guess the coaching conversation can come a little bit later, but it's or whenever you like. But that sense of agency, play with some labels that might get us more quickly to what we need than, you know how long it can take in complex situations to sense what's going on in the body. And I'm not saying we don't need to do that. We do, but helpful to help. It's been so helpful for me personally over the years of researching this, to understand that where I was brought up with my sister, very close in age to me, who was born with a severe physical disability, spina bifida. She was 1 year older than me. And I grew up dancing. Literally, I was dancing everywhere, from the bedroom to the bathroom to clean my teeth. I would dance there. Why walk there when you could dance there? So that was me. Whereas my sister was severe. You know, I watched her struggle and with to move and to walk, and I watched her cope with a very difficult body. I watched her in pain. So that context gave my dancing, my early dancing, whilst sometimes I'd be full of joy, especially as a young, you know, I wouldn't be impacted by the environment. But as I got older and I understood it more, I contracted. So some of my dancing, the technical moves, which would be more difficult, were done from a contracted state, and it was really unhelpful. So I learned and I taught myself to release and trust in order to do the more difficult technical moves. So I didn't grip, because I'd then fall over, or, you know, it's a bit like skiing. If you get tense and scared. I'm a terrible skier, by the way, just awful. I like to be on solid ground, not on shiny, slippy things that go fast without me wanting them to. But it's like that. The minute you tense up, then the center is lost, the flow is lost. So the reason I'm telling this story is because I really realized through that those early experiences that it was cortisol, an overproduction of cortisol, the stress and arousal chemical, which we need to wake us up in the morning. We absolutely need it. But it was holding on to me. It was putting me in the grip. And what I needed was to balance that with particularly with serotonin, which is expansion, release, flow. Yes, it's the happy hormone, you know, it's one of the happy hormones. And we hear about that on a top level in the press and on the internet and so on. But it does so much more, this incredibly beautiful chemical serotonin. Gives us our ability to modulate between fast and slow movement and everything in between. It literally gives us our flow and enables us to sit still and feel expansive. So therefore, you know, you can go to, again, this is a bit of a leap, but the serotonin production and the pineal gland are connected, it seems. And there you go to an expanded sense of the world, to awe. Some people connect that to their own spirituality journey. Other people just, it's about human awe, whatever you want to call it. But that expansion that comes as a real, yeah, product of serotonin is incredible. And I needed it in my dancing. And now I'm doing my doctorate and working on that as a principle for leadership. You know, the flexible and agile leader is so critical for today, because it's a pretty damn complex and tricky world out there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's actually really helpful to hear that example. And I'm wondering if we could almost like sketch out, you know, maybe that some of the four qualities you named, but you know, you talked about leadership. Could you give us some more examples and weave in some more of the chemicals involved that can, you know, articulate what becomes possible really when we start to, you know, to work with our physical intelligence in this way?
Yeah. Well, let's start with strength then. And this is the foundations of our strength, our stability, if you like, is the adrenal function. And so the adrenal glands in our backs, just sitting like little bobble hats on top of the kidneys. And they literally keep us alive. I was with a large group of consultants and business people a little while ago, and I said, where are your adrenals? And one thought that we were in the leg, and the other thought that they got them mixed up with the thyroid gland in the throat. And so I personally think it's very important to know where your adrenals are, so you can thank them every day for waking you up and getting you out of bed. So adrenal stability relies on our levels of arousal getting us into action and triggering our muscles to speed up enough to move us into the actual action. And then also to be able to stand and hold ground, to feel and appear confident yet approachable. And in certain situations, I'm thinking about a film of Maori hunters approaching a group of lions who've already killed and they want to take a cut of the lion's meat. They have to dominate. They have to show that they're absolutely, you know, superior to the lions, and they take space. So sometimes, I mean, I worked with, a civil servant, worked with a few civil servants here in the British government, and one of them talked about their strength, a kind of elevated sense of their strength, as having the risk tolerance to go in and be very strong with unions where there are very strong voices in the room, and just to be able to create a dialogue where there's that level of conflict. And some of the key chemistry that underlies that, as well as cortisol and adrenaline that are created in the adrenal glands, there is also testosterone, much talked about, in some ways much maligned because we consider it the chemical of aggression. But it is also it is the chemical of aggression when it's combined with rising cortisol. So it's very important to contextualize testosterone, but what it does for non-over-aroused human beings is give a sense of independence and risk tolerance and grounding. And the all-important part is that the flip side of the adrenal chemistry can work at the same time so that you're not going into dominance and arousal, you're over-arousal, you're able to balance your adrenaline with this other chemical. People have heard tend to hear of this one less, but it's absolutely vital. It's the flip side, which is the acetylcholine. And if you've, you know, we know about the vagus nerve, and it's the key nerve of the parasympathetic nervous system, the release of acetylcholine. So adrenaline balances with acetylcholine, and then one other chemical is really important to get a sense of for our inner stability, because it's part of the recovery. So it balances the arousal chemistry and it balances cortisol. And that's called DHEA, dehydroepiandrosterone. And that really gives us vitality, life. It regulates our heart-brain connection, the coherence, that's another term that we know from the heart math research, that really, you know, it really creates this clarity of underlying state. So all of that is wrapped in strength, and all of that might be the first component that if I'm coaching, or if people that I've trained in physical intelligence, that we've trained in physical intelligence, might take into a coaching room, is just that background knowledge of, okay, how much adrenal stability can I read here, and how much is that person reporting waking up at 3 a.m. and working with levels of worry and anxiety? In which case, we know that cortisol is beating DHEA. There's too much being withdrawn from the bank and not enough deposited. And then we can go to breath work and various other techniques to balance the adrenal stability. That's just in the strength. So I've named the chemicals of the strength component, that the strength element. It will be a long answer, Joel, if I go into that depth with all three others, but I'm happy to, that I'm aware that I'm very geeky about this. I
Well,
can
no, I
go
love that.
on and
So
on.
I'm fascinated. I'd love to do that, but let's stay with this a bit longer. So,
Okay.
I love the nuance of this, and what I'm wondering is, how do I formulate this question? So, you know, for example, with this client who you get, the civil servant who may need to go into this environment with, you know, strong characters, strong opinions. How would you help them kind of find the optimal balance? And inside of that, I'm assuming that's what you want to do, you know, like, so are you, in a way, kind of like with your client before they go into that situation, you're kind of like, you know, through talking to them and being with them, you're assessing, you know, what, and exploring what kind of balance of chemicals might be there, and then offering a kind of suite of practices that would help them find that optimum balance, so that when they go in there, you know, they're not like pumped up on, I'm going to show my ignorance around chemical, like on testosterone, you know. So yeah, I think you've got enough there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's exactly the idea, that as bespoke as possible, practices, as or rather as bespoke a combination as possible, for a coachee, you know, that you've arrived at together in dialogue. The coachee sort of always leading the coach there, in a sense. But you've arrived at what for that situation is a mode of preparing. It might start months earlier because it can take a little bit of time, you know, of regular breath pattern. Pacing the breath is one of the, there's a very strong piece of research about that that shows that if we pace our breath pattern to become rhythmic and reliably so, so that we're more often likely to have entrained ourselves to breathe that way because we've done some conscious practice. So then it naturally bleeds into the unconscious moments where we're involved with something else. We're not very good at, having a whole conversation with somebody and thinking about pacing your breath. It's not, but you practice it when you're not in the moment, and that gives you the adrenal chemistry that enables you to then perform, if you like, in a moment freely without needing to think about it. So with my civil servant client, he adopted, I think it was 20 minutes of breath pattern, breath work in the morning that was about regulating his breath. And 10 minutes of that was still, and the other 10 minutes was coordinated with making a cup of coffee, integrated into, his walk to the tube station was also done in a regulated pace. And we worked out that if he had an incredible way of walking, like he pushed off his feet so fast that his heels never hardly touched the ground. And he was just in pace. He was in a fast pace right from when he woke up. So we just slowed it down just a bit and paced his walking pattern with his breath, slightly faster cadence than the still breath because he needed a little bit more oxygen, but still slower than he would have gone. So he notched up 20 minutes in the morning and he had another 20 minutes at different times of day. And the research talks about if you can stack up 40 minutes of conscious, regularly paced breathing, especially when you're starting to know what it feels like to have your adrenals balanced and stable, to be able to conjure up some additional strength. And I'll show you how he did that in just a moment. But we started with breath. So that reliably brings in the DHEA to balance the cortisol. Then he needed to protocol sort of gauge how his anxiety, worry, and confidence levels were beforehand, and then have things to do, right, that could just nudge the chemistry into touch. And with him, for him, it was like rising and expanding into the challenge. So of course, there's a postural element. I just got him to imagine his body with a very bright floodlight shining through it, and the skeleton being visible as a shadow, like an X-ray on the wall, and getting him to imagine that between the bones there was space. There were nothing was crammed together or contracted. It was expanded, and that gave him a sense of taking up space without, going, I'm clenching my muscles now and kind of my fists without going into something that looks like it might tip him into aggression because he wants to negotiate, right? This is what it's about. Then the third thing that I remember doing was to actually give himself a little bit of adrenaline and testosterone if he felt, I just can't face those unions today. That feeling. We all have it about some things and on some days. So what happens when I gave him just a very simple thing. Some people like to press the heels of their hands together or press a fist against a hand. Can take your pick. Shoulders down. You might like to try this, Joel. I don't know if you want to try this and see what happens. But that when you anchor your shoulders down, you might feel a little bit of activation through your core, and you put pressure in between those two surfaces, and you breathe, and it doesn't limit your breathing, but you're actually firming your muscles in a certain way that says, I'm about to need to exert some energy. I need some energy, please. And the adrenals are listening because you're activating the muscles all around the adrenals. And the closer the activation is to the adrenals, the quicker the message. It's just physics. So the adrenals say, oh, okay, I'll give you some testosterone because that's also made in the adrenals, and an adrenaline for the moment. So those are the three things that were specific to that very challenging moment with a lot of people and a lot of important stuff on his shoulders. Yeah.
Brilliant. I notice as I do that, yeah, it brings a kind of expansion and brightening and a sense of like increased capability. And like feeling good, you know, actually
Yeah.
just like enjoyable to make that posture.
I love that description, brightening and increased capability, that sort of sense of possibility and capability. Love that.
I've got a lot of questions bubbling up. So let me ask you first, do you think, you know, for example, if you discover you've got low testosterone in general, do you think it's possible to begin through practice to raise that testosterone through some of these physical intelligence postures or movements or practices?
Absolutely, I do. And I think it's the first place we should go to rather than, dosing from outside and see what can be done with the natural system and really inquire into how it's being used, how that system is being used. And more often than not, when the knowledge is there and maybe you've got some visual imagery, I find that very helpful if you can imagine what's actually happening in the body because someone's explained some physiology that just makes sense, and suddenly you've got this picture of what's happening. Then, you might want to imagine testosterone with a certain color and a certain force being garnered in the adrenal glands. And all of this is very powerful and gives us that sense of agency. Of course, there are some conditions where we need help, and I'm not absolutely not saying that people shouldn't seek help from external sources where there is a real, where something is not functioning as it should, and whatever you do, the system can't seem to accommodate it. But it's very powerful to realize is that the systems of the body are all entwined, and that sometimes we can heal ourselves. And sometimes, I mean, I might not be here unless there are antibiotics, could I, because I had a couple of occasions where I really needed them, and I'm very thankful for Western medicine and antibiotics as well. So I embrace all. I was in a session the other day with, again, some other consultants who work very hard, work hard, play hard, work, just work, 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 work. And they asked me about micro dosing, and I just had to say, the chemistry factory that's in the body can do more for you before you do that. So work your own chemistry first is my advice.
This is perfectly teased up the other question I have, which is, what do you think, what capacity do we have if we learn about, you know, leveraging our physical intelligence in this way? Sometimes I get the sense that we're like only just tapping into some of the possibilities for how we could become more skillful and access different states, positive states, high performance states. What's your sense of that?
I think that every year there's new re apart from anything else, my own experience tells me that that is the case. There's a lot we can do. That's why I'm completely, utterly passionate about that term, and how embodiment is an intelligence. And it feels to me like that upgrades its status a little. So I kind of like that in the world. I think we need to allow the physical realm without negating any other intelligence to have its status. But also I've actually just lost track of where I was going with this. Your question was about
I mean, in a way, I'm asking like, what's your sense of what's
what
possible,
we can
really,
do.
when we start to, you know, and is there anything also that blows your mind with it?
So I got taken off track by this, you know, this word intelligence and the status part of my work, and all of us that work in embodiment. And I think the answer to the question is that the body is incredible, and our inner experience of it, once we can visualize and understand a little bit of physiological, correct physiological knowledge, goes a long way. We can access it. And then if we can have some chemical labels and play with that cocktail, it does seem to be a way in that I've hit on. And the other aspect, apart from the inner experience, is that every year there is major new research that comes out that shows in different ways this incredible connection between, if you like, between the mind and the body, although those are not distinct entities as we know now. The mind is the body is the mind, the brain is something that's all through the body. It's all one big neural network. And so, for example, 2023, just we're recording in 2024, but just last year, scientists, it was published in Nature Journal, which, you know, top publication. Scientists discovered a mystery neuron in the motor cortex of the brain, and that these mystery neurons were highly networked throughout the whole body-brain system, all of it going to the motor cortex. And what they believe is happening is that there's this consultation with movement, with every plan that we have. So we might plan to move in a certain way, and that unlocks some behavioral flexibility. We might plan to move in a certain way because that releases some, like the civil servant, some energy and capability to cope with force coming his way. So science and inner experience tell us that there's much more we can do with the body, and I'm probably scratching the surface. We're all scratching the surface because the science is beginning, you know, the level of acceleration of the science is incredible. By the way, that's called the SCAN network, somatocognitive action network. There we go, SCAN network, if you want to look it up.
I mean, I find it fascinating that we're still discovering, you know, these like we call them mystery neurons, I think you said, you know, in the body, which, you know, you think we've kind of like mapped the body out, you know, with the so it's fascinating that that's happening in and of itself. I find, I mean, I think we'll get into like how coaches can apply physical intelligence in their work as well. But maybe actually let's go back to like one of the other four kind of you know, qualities that you described, and then I'd love to like unpack that in the same way because I find that incredible. Is there one you want to go to? I think there was like flexibility, resilience, and endurance.
Yeah, I think we should go to flexibility. It's a sort of natural sequence to first of all understand that within these four elements, one is constructed and built on the other. So it's harder to have good resilience if you haven't got adrenal balance and strength, and it's hard to feel creative and flexible and to reach and connect and experiment and explore and all those things that are about our flexibility. If you haven't got the confidence to reach out, if you believe you're going to be the world's going to attack you, or there's something not safe out there, you'll keep your extremities in. And by its very nature, flexibility invites us to reach out into space and extend and explore and be curious. So that's why I've gotten so interested in serotonin, because it's the chemical that fl enables us to flow out and is also connected with creativity. So within the cocktail of flexibility are serotonin that I've already talked about and oxytocin, which we haven't talked about yet, but is so important in the coaching relationship. Many people will already have heard about oxytocin as the love hormone. It's a hormone and a neurotransmitter, one of the few that are both. And the news is that it's really interesting that it's released by the independent neural network in the heart area, in the heart muscle, as well as in the pituitary gland in the brain. So the body is the body is the brain. The body is a neural network, and particularly when it comes to oxytocin, that's released independently in the heart. Serotonin, as many people will know, is released and store is synthesized and released and stored in the gut. So very important body areas. Not surprising that so many of our feelings and sensations, and ailments and sense of discomfort will go to gut, will go to heart, then will go up to shoulders and neck. These are classic areas, then jaw. So flexibility, the ability to reach out and connect with others, the ability to be curious and creative ourselves, and then the third chemical in main chemical in the creativity cocktail is dopamine. Much talked about, very familiar sort of in terms of addiction and use, using up resources, wanting more, being more, doing more. And there's a real danger with that chemical if it's out of balance, if it's got lots of cortisol with it, the stress hormone, then we'll tend to just want more, to be more, to do more, not sure more of what, but just that eternal hunger. Nothing is ever, we're never satisfied or satiated, which is a feature of serotonin. So agreeable, peaceable goes out the window when you've got high dopamine, high cortisol. You might be having a great time and having a lot of fun, and you don't need to be, you know, taking up arms against somebody to be carried away with dopamine and cortisol. But it's one of the very key things, I think, which this particular part of the narrative of the dopamine cortisol combination, life today, and the need to evolve into more peaceable humans because resources are becoming more scarce. Boundaries are being fought over eternally. And the question is, you know, can we accelerate our evolution into a more serotonergic and oxytocinergic impact on the world? Is it possible for humans to change that? And I believe it is. And I believe many people make that transformation, sometimes through coaching, sometimes through an awakening, something that happens that transforms them. And on some level, I think the chemicals, why we're all involved in helping people transform and in a sense, our own transformation through life, I think is a lot to do with that chemical narrative. So, yeah, at best, dopamine is about having fun, being creative, feeling rewarded by life. But you need the serotonin and oxytocin there. If all you've got is dopamine and cortisol, it's pretty much a recipe for disaster all round.
And I'm hearing, you know, as you're explaining that, I'm thinking of our modern life and the stimulus around us, both in terms of, you know, like social media and, you know, kind of the impact of like continually absorbing negative news or polarized political views, kind of combined with like ready access to junk food and, you know, kind of. You know, me and my wife were remarking on like these apps now in the Netherlands where you can just like, you know, they've removed the barrier to like walking to the shop to buy a bag of potato chips, you know, and now it's like you could just come to your house, you know, in like 20 minutes. So it seems like modern life is kind of stacking against us in that term. And I'm curious, you said something quite interesting to me, which was like people, you know, through coaching or awakening type experiences can kind of begin to access this different combination of like serotonin and oxytocin. Could you talk about like that transformation? What's occurring for people there? What examples have you seen of that?
Well, I think at an extreme point, and it depends on the kind of coach that you are, but if we think about trauma with a big T, which we know is a very specialized area of work, and trauma with a small T, which is we're always bumping into patterns. I call them, and Antonio Damasio calls them somatic markers, this sort of sense of the chemical imprint of time that repeats in our bodies, in our feeling, and makes the reality of a moment through the perspective of an old lens from the past. And so at a very fundamental and very important level, a coach bringing oxytocin into the room and mirroring back acceptance of emotions like shame or guilt, where that client might be feeling that or associating that with certain things that have happened to them then or are happening to them, then that just that bringing that oxytocin into the room, just knowing how to do that, can start to soften the grip of those replaying patterns of musculoskeletal tension, for example, and then the replay of the chemistry. So that's really significant. And I guess you've had it done to you, but there are certain people that when I talk to them, I somehow find my way to saying things that are really connecting what is now, what is useful, what is enriching. And it's such a beautiful thing. And pretty much they're showing up with a bag load of oxytocin, testosterone in the back pocket, because they might need to challenge me. But it's always done through the lens of love, the oxytocin, the compassion. So there's some of the chemistry, you know, when we're talking about trauma. And what I love about the coaching industry now is that there used to be such a fine line between we're not going to deal with the past. We're coaches, and we deal with now into the future. But I think we're understanding, even in the last 5 years, this understanding has changed that we are both past, present, and future all at the same time. And I love the dissolving of those clear boundaries. And it's up to the coach how comfortable you feel going into particularly the embodied expression of negative situations that have negative connotations for you. And every coach is different with that. And then there's a lot more to say about that, but I'm going to just take us somewhere else, then hand back over, because I just wanted to also say that, you know, the ability to celebrate and have joy and bring joy to the coaching process comes from the coach and gets shared as an enjoyment of the process. And I think there's the opportunity, and then the important thing in transformation is that we want to move towards it because it feels much better than what was. There's a freedom, there's a breath, there's space, there's things to construct and build, there's a desire to create, there's a desire to be alive. And I think sometimes, very often, coaches are helping people find their path from a struggle tense life with various issues going on to a more expansive creative life and many more things. But there's that release into happiness that very often comes within the coaching relationship. You know, you discover things and it's beautiful.
Yeah, as you speak, it's beautiful what you share. I'm just imagining a world where we've we're both doing that work to begin to resolve the different types of trauma that then affects the chemicals that are showing up in our bodies, which then impacts the way we relate to others. And so people are learning to be able to integrate that and shift their chemical compositions in the moment. I'm thinking of, like, you know, the need for collaboration on great levels for us to be able to respond to the challenges we face, and thinking of how we could design not just the ways we interact, like if leaders are coming together and having certain rituals and practices and in the way they interact, which open up these, you know, the chemical pathways for greater, you know, flexibility and connection, but even the environments that people are in, you know, the buildings and the kind of the extended kind of environments that people find themselves in. And there's all of this comes together to be able to, you know, enact like a new ways of new creativity and solutions to challenges. Whereas, you know, if you contrast that to what you see now, and we've talked a lot about this on the podcast with the polarized views, and you know, I'm now thinking of what chemicals are being fired up in people's bodies as they absorb that. It's quite a stark contrast, you know. So and just one more thing I'll add, and I don't know if you can respond with anything. You know, as you talk about these chemicals, I think about people maturing, and both in terms of like the sense of expansion, you know. So I've seen this in my own life and with my clients, where there's this tipping point where they're doing this integrative work, and then there's a kind of you know, a meta awareness or an expansion that takes place where, and I'm now relating that to serotonin. It's like they're coming from an expanded sense of self, and they are more resilient, more flexible, more creative. And then inside of that shift, they're also more self-loving. So, you know, they've developed this meta competency of like, yeah, when am I'm not guided by my inner critic or parts, you know. When I feel a sense of lack, I can meet that with this expanded sense of love, and same with other people. So it's like I can, yeah, it's fascinating for me to think about that now in terms of these kind of chemical, it's almost like a kind of virtually enhancing positive cycle or something, you know, of everything firing together.
Yeah. And what you're hitting on there, you know, in what you've said is both oxytocin and serotonin, which is this, I think these are two really, really important parts of our neurochemistry. So yeah, I've got a couple of responses there that were just coming to mind as you were speaking. And the first is just to pick up on this trend, and a very liberating trend, to take coaching out walking. A lot of people have been writing about it, talking about it. And, you know, firstly, the association with, I mean, you and I have transcended it. I love listening to you. I love talking with you. So I'm not in the same pattern of chemistry as I might be if I'm looking at our business budgets, for example. So I feel we have transcended that, but a lot of time spent on screens, and then also coaching on screens, if we're doing that virtually, it can just mean it harder to break out of the chemistry. But getting on the phone and going out for both parties, going out for a walk, or even better, getting together and walking, you know, when we fall into step with each other, oxytocin's released. And we've all had that experience, haven't we, of that you know, outside, it's a different kind of conversation that you tend to have. So it liberates the words, the language, the imagery. And that's where the dopamine effect is in there. So we need that dopamine effect, because it's, we're looking around, we're seeing different colors and textures, and that's dopamine, very connected with what we see visually, noticing patterns, noticing beauty, noticing color, noticing texture, and that influencing our emotions. So we have to thank dopamine for all of that, and not, you know, not be too harsh on it. So that's walking, and there's a lot to say about that with the alternation of arm and leg, encouraging the connectivity through the corpus callosum, the M25 bridge in the brain that helps the whole all areas of the brain to connect. When we move in that way, it fires up better connections. So that's partly what's happening when we are improving our creativity through walking. Stanford research that's been around for a while since 2014 shows us that we get better ideas when we're walking, high quality creative ideas when we're walking rather than seated. So that's one thing. And I think that relates to what you're saying about environment and space. You know, if we keep repeating the same patterns of use of space, then we are going to repeat the same, we're more likely to repeat the same patterns of emotional, mental constructs and functioning. Then you talked about integrated access, the sense that, and I'm glad it's communicating, because this serotonin, I think, is a real key. We all worked on our serotonin and understood, you know, that expansion of the posture, the floodlight coming through, and the bones being able to float outwards. So, in a sense, being more aware of centrifugal force, the spinning of the planet, rather than gravity, the one that's pinning us to the planet, although we need both. Obviously, we're held in this beautiful balance between the two. But when we expand, there's more of a sense, you know, we can move into that expansion. It's a bit like trying to pick up a dancer that doesn't want to be lifted. They can, you know, someone that doesn't want to be picked up, or a dog that doesn't want to go for a walk, you know, can be incredibly heavy. They're using, you know, gravity and their muscular tension to pin them down. But you know, when we used to do lots of lifts and flying through the air, you can make yourself lighter and you feel lighter and more expansive. It's a choice at some level if you know how to flick the switch. So I think the expanded self, and the physiology of that and the potential of that to be offered to leaders through movement. And I need to talk about that because that's a very unusual bit, right? We're going to improve our leadership and we're going to do that through movement. Come on, you know, that's a bit far-fetched. Well, actually, it's just so not far-fetched because of what we're discovering with the different kinds of movement that will give us different kinds of behaviors. So that's really, you know, we could go there and have a little look at behavioral flexibility and how that is impacted by the type of movement. So that's my response so far to
Yeah, I'd
your
actually
offer.
love to do that. I was thinking of, you know, we kind of gave an example with strength before of you working with someone. I don't know if you have like an example of how you might work with a client around flexibility and the role of movement inside of that. What practices, you know, you've already named some, but like are effective in bringing up serotonin and oxytocin and with a balanced level of dopamine. So yeah, I don't know if you've got any, yeah, if you've got what.
Definitely. And I'm going to do a new one because it's nice to do new things, and it's part of what's coming out of my doctorate, which could be an expanded and expansive model for leadership or framework, if that feels more flexible. In my doctorate, I'm painting this picture of the lived experience and how that connects with science, and they should really, really interlink, rather than science being over here saying no, lived experience being over here saying yes. They need to be very close because they're becoming closer and closer. So the phenomenon of being alive and the science of being alive. So part of my doctorate's about that, and then painting the picture of the chemistry of what allows that to happen gets into serotonin. And what we haven't talked about yet is that serotonin, it appears from the research, from the science, is it supports our interoception. So this very, very important skill we have to sense what's going on inside the body brain system. So then that becomes a critical serotonin, serotonin enhances that interoception. It's critical for it, actually. It doesn't just enhance it. Takes us to a place where we can understand and want to be expanded in leadership. And the idea of that then is that whereas contraction, linearity, seeking the simple truth, seeking one truth in a very complex environment, seeking solutions in such complexity brings tension. And actually, my thesis is that we absolutely need that expandability to be able to even cope with the levels of unknown and uncertainty and complexity. So it's like Project Serotonin, really, for me. And so then, how do you get serotonin? So that's a long-winded explanation to say this is why we need to do exercises that do particular things with our body that release serotonin. This is how we can get some. And so I searched high and low, read through all the research, and finally found what I knew to be true, which is one section of a review on serotonin that says manual stimulation of the enteric area, the gut area, and the gut-brain axis, manual stimulation of that area in the gut and up. Releases serotonin from these independent neurons. So it was a great relief to find that because I kind of knew I could sense that that was what's happening, but it was one of those buried pieces of research. So I've got very interested now in the act of reaching, the act of reaching out. Because if you just take your arm out and just your arm and you don't move the center of the body, you haven't really got any reach. You've just got the length of the arm. But if you reach, you have to engage and stretch the abdomen. If you're going to reach with your arm, if you're going to reach with your leg, you have to stretch through the abdomen. And the idea of reaching and being curious and reaching into new territory is very important for leadership. So I've got a series of reaches that look a little, they might look a little bit like a jazz routine, I don't know, but we don't do them with a jazz beat, but we do them really to feel that serotonin release. And when you come back from that request for reach and flexibility in, through the whole body. I don't know about you, but you can, you feel free to try this, but I always feel, oh yes, I can expand further. And I've literally reached further and I feel more expansive. And then reaching up, reaching down to the floor, reaching behind you into the back spaces with all those connotations about the past and whatever, however people construct their space around them is often temporal. And you can reach diagonally high and forwards. The act of reaching. And what's really good fun is you get to where you think your limit is. And then generally, there's a few more millimeters, if not centimeters. And it's quite a joy to reach for them. Okay, so that's one of many quite advent that's an adventurous movement, isn't it? It says, reaching out. Some people who don't use their body very much may feel extremely self-conscious the minute that they even take their gesture away from the center line of the body. I've met people that just moving the hands to either side of the shoulders, they feel incredibly vulnerable straight away. And we need to work with that all the time. And some that self-consciousness sometimes can be through invitation, stepped over to experience and then come back to safety. Or sometimes it needs to be respected right there and then, and then find a physical practice that will allow it gradually and gently to increase.
Yeah, that's Great, because that my question, well, first of all, when I was doing the reaching with you, it does feel joyful. I start to feel joy and expansive. So I'll come back to my question in a moment. And so is that reaching, so you're saying that's actually starting to activate, increase the levels of serotonin in the body as we reach like that?
So it's literally stimulating the gut tissue because you have to stretch there through that whole area. And these serotonergic neurons are releasing serotonin. That's jumping onto the vagus nerve. Again, this is a recent discovery. Because we thought that serotonin was going to, go not be able to cross the blood-brain barrier because it was a slow-moving thing, but actually, it's hijacked the nervous system and it goes straight up to the brain by hopping onto the vagus nerve, which is why it has such a, if we can attune to it in a way, take the medicine that's on offer internally. We can feel it straight away. You can always block these things because if you're saying no to it in your body and you go through the motions, you're self-inhibiting the chemistry. You're more likely to hold on to the cortisol, or whatever the counteracting chemistry is. And that may be through fear. It may not be ready to reach out. If we're talking specifically about reaching, there's lots of other types of movement that relate to leadership. So, yeah. The serotonin twist is also a very popular one. I just done my TEDx talk, and I've given that to the world in that. But it's a very, I mean, we twist, if we do a yoga class, or we twist if we reach to get something from behind us. But the twist is another manipulation, stimulation of the gut area, and we'll do the same. Yeah.
I was just in conversation with Richard Beatsis talking about the necessity of entering renewal states and throughout the day, states of renewal and states that are conducive to learning. And this feels totally in that zone for me. If like, imagine if people were to start to do this throughout the day. And I wonder about how you apply this with clients, and just that. Let's go first to the example you shared, where actually there might be a, someone might actually reach and start to feel a boundary or a block, and maybe that points to trauma or conditioning, and there's an intelligence to that conditioning. Maybe it was protecting them in some way. How do you work with that in your coaching? Because you could just push through that, and maybe there's value to that in moments, but it seems valuable that we're able to begin to integrate the conditioning or the patterning that blocks certain expressions.
I mean, I think that conversation about both getting into the reach, finding a boundary, exploring what the sensation of that is, what it connects to in the main body, in the torso, what it's like at the extremities, what does it feel like? What is it in a way? And as you approach that, what's your body saying to you? Because it'll talk back. It'll talk back in words that even make complete sense. If you ask it, what are you saying? Oh, I'm saying that feels a bit dangerous. What is the danger? Let's explore. Hang out there for a minute. Come back to where it's safe. Now, when you approach that danger point where it feels too much, what's going on in the whole body? Let's freeze frame there for a moment. What's happening to the breath? What's body saying to you? What's happened to the eyes? What's changing in the way that you're seeing the world and the tension around the eyes? Wherever you want to go, and you're observing, but those are like in any coaching. It's the gift of embodiment in coaching that gives you the chance to explore the whole of a person as they. Through the metaphor of movement, through the activation of movement, so they can explore blocks, explore being stuck, which is so core to what we do, isn't it? So those are high value. It's better than doing it blasting through it and doing a is not about doing a perfect set of reaches and feeling good. It's about what's the experience of doing that? What's it telling you about your journey through life and what you want to be doing with your doing in your life and with yourself? And how does the client connect it? It's all about those connections.
For me, there would be value in, yeah, just kind of adding to what you're saying is like, yeah, there's like information revealing in that moment, which can be met with love, you know, with, and can integrate, can soften, metabolize as that happens. So, so just thinking about this example of like, you know, you kind of said before about the leader or, you know, people or a way of being which can be like focused on maybe narrowly or like on one thing rather than the whole. I'm thinking about how you might work with flexibility with a client, you know. For example, maybe they're in a situation where they need to really be kind of expansive and flexible and make these connections. And how would you see them developing that capacity through a coaching journey, through, you know, practicing reaching and things like that?
Yeah. Well, one example jumps to mind, which I'll tell you about. And I think I'm very aware that as I describe some of the bigger movements, and I'll show you, I'll describe what we did with this particular client who really, really needed more flexibility for a role that they were moving into. I'm just really aware that when we go straight to them, it can seem extreme and odd. And I just want to be really clear that this is a sort of carefully built up exploration of the whole human with a coach that can work with the whole human, with a client who has developed the desire through the quality of the dialogue to work with their whole human. So I'm not prescribing quick movement fixes. I just want to be clear about that, because when we train coaches in physical intelligence, we're also not doing a kind of pure science lesson. But what happens through our program is that at the beginning, we lay down some science and it feels as though we're learning some fragments. And then as it goes through, we go through strength, flexibility, resilience, endurance, and you see how the practical things that we've done just start to integrate and build to up to endurance, which is a life well lived. It's not a life suffering because things are hard. It's a life that where you can bring your energy and your focus. So towards at the beginning, I think, oh, there's lots of science. And then by the end, coaches are saying, I think I need a different kind of coach for myself, because now I'm feeling the need for to be asked about the body, and I feel the need to be working all the time with the body. And so this is the bigger message. And really, really, I'm going to just be bold and say it, right? And if I make people uncomfortable, I'm really, really sorry. It's not my intention, but I really think we all need to be working with the body, not in the way that I do, but in the way that you do you. But I think coaching's going to get very quickly out of date unless we can go into the body.
I mean,
there we are. I said it.
I'm with you on that. We have our own embodied coaching, but in a way that we have to speak about it is interesting, because it's like we feel like we could work with someone without the body feels, because we are our bodies, you know, like that idea of like the mind body connection is actually an illusionary kind of idea, really. It's like,
yeah, it is.
The mind and body are like intimately intertwined, you know, they're co-arising in each moment. So yes, I'm completely with you. And actually transformation for me is occurring in our embodied experience moment by moment. That's the possibility. So yeah, love your boldness there.
And I guess if we can move, we can become more comfortable moving it into movement, we get even more from that embodied connection. Sensing what's going on in the body is becoming much more common. And I've taken it upon myself to help offer, because coming from a dance background, the use of movement as well as breath and sensation. So that might be something that I hope maybe is a legacy. I hope there are others, of course, there's others using movement as well. Of somatic intelligence, movement is very powerful. So I've got an outstanding case study to tell you, haven't I? I said I would tell you about this guy.
Yeah. And just
shall
noticing our
now?
Time, I can go over a few minutes, but I don't know about you. So
it's gone so fast. It's just gone so fast. All right, quick story then. So this is a man, and he would call himself a king maker, not a king, right? He's in a bank. Big bank, and he gets offered a CEO role for a large part of the world. Okay, but he's a kingmaker. He stands at the back of the room like a chief of staff. You know, doesn't want the limelight. Arms folded, will come forward, but from the back of the room, say some very intelligent, crisp things. But will not be the front man. Gets this role, gulps. Accepts it, then realizes that he doesn't have the skills to expand and do that. So I end up working with him, and I realize that he is one of these people that just gets very jumpy when the arms come away from the center line. I was speaking about that earlier, that immediately makes him feel uncomfortable and self-conscious. So respecting all of that, we explore, and I say, look, I think what we're going to need to do is respect the self-consciousness, but I want to give you a program of movement, because I think if you practice, like practicing a piano scale, you can get the notes even, and it starts to feel like there's flow, whereas at the beginning it might feel very difficult to coordinate finger by finger and get any sense of the run of a scale on a piano, for example. So why don't we do that? Why don't we build up the sequence of movements, which is what we ended up doing? And they all had words to go with them, because he wanted his voice to become alive as well, because it was rather clipped and monotone. And so I gave him a movement, a series of movements that included a twist, included reaches, included push and pull, float, expand, scatter, gather. We just made up words about things that concepts that he felt he might need to be enacting or behaving in certain ways. He definitely need to scatter ideas out and see what seeds were sown, and definitely gather, harvest people's talks. He wanted to listen to people. This was the thing. Listening is really important. So we found those movements that did that. And he practiced religiously every day for a couple of months, did some vocal pitch exercises as well. Really changed himself. He just had to practice. He just needed to do something every day to get the muscular memory to accept a broader range of movement. And then I think he said to me that really changed his way of thinking. So he then became more a leader that was more able to share personal stories, be more open, make himself vulnerable. All the things that we know draw, create oxytocin and create followership and great leadership. So, yeah, I was really pleased with that one. That was it was a good experiment. It was a number of years ago. So I was sort of just cutting my teeth on this serotonin movement. How far could we go with it? And it was very successful. Like anything, if we practice the physical aspects of something, there are emotional and as we've said, it's all connected, so our behavior changes. And there's a lot to be done with a lot of research around actually with you know, if you move flexibly in a deliberate way, I think this is research from Tokyo, there is this improvement in creative cognition, just being more able to come up with ideas and make decisions. So when we move, we're affecting how we think. Affecting the kind of energy we bring to different circumstances.
I've loved it. I love these stories, and as you share, I'm in touch with just the incredible field that coaching is, and the different elements of what people are bringing in, and the focus areas of focus. And I actually really feel like I could just carry on for another hour and ask you about other elements of this. I find it really fascinating. And like I said at the beginning, for me, like our physicality feels like such an untapped kind of area of leverage for like greater collaboration, well-being, creativity. And I just say that because on one level, that might seem obvious, but for me, I've been involved in fields where, whilst people really were working in an embodied way, there was a lot of emphasis on like maybe more esoteric or spiritual or fan I don't know, we use the word fancy kind of, because this is really fancy to me, what you're saying. But I think I'm just saying it to get it to make a point. It's so powerful. So I just want to thank you. And I do want to ask you, you've talked about training coaches, and where can we find out more about your work and what you do with coaches?
Yes, thank you for asking me. And that last thing you said about the embodiment work can seem to sit in an esoteric world, and that I absolutely love making this tangible, felt, scientific, felt, lived. So that's absolutely my mission. Physicalintelligenceinstitute.com is where you can look around and find our coach training. And of course, I'm going to be bringing some of this to the neuroscience of change coming up very soon. So I'm very excited about that. Yeah, that's it. And Claire Dale on LinkedIn. I mean, like all of us, I'm just love connecting into this world with people that care about this stuff. So happy to be in dialogue.
Thanks so much, Claire. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.